So prostate cancer is actually very common. It's the most common cancer in men. Bar none, it's the most common cancer. So any individual has about a 15% lifetime risk of prostate cancer. That's actually pretty high. It's important that you kind of understand this because not everyone dies of prostate cancer. And there's kind of a gradient of prostate cancer. Some that are very bad, you really should take seriously. Some that really aren't. And so the lifetime risk of dying of prostate cancer is about 3%, meaning of all deaths, about 3% are attributable to prostate cancer. So it's not huge when you consider that 15% of people have it. Total numbers in the US, it's around 290,000 people a year are diagnosed with prostate cancer. That's a lot. And around 35,000 people a year die of prostate cancer.
This is the Man Up Podcast, Doctor's Guide to Men's Health. Each week on our podcast, we interview the top specialists of the field on various topics in men's health. If you have questions that you are too afraid to ask, we have the answers. This week, our episode is titled Prostate Cancer 101, Part 1. I'm Dr. Kevin Chu, and I'm joined as always with my co-host, Dr. Justin Dubin. What's good, my friend?
Football is back, baby.
All right.
I am absolutely pumped. We just wrapped up game one. The Lions have upset the Chiefs. The Chiefs have garbage wide receivers led by Kadarius Toney, who's garbage.
You know, they're missing Tyreek right now. You know, Travis wasn't playing, but you know, they're missing Tyreek. They're missing, you know, I guess they missed Juju Smith.
Well, Tyreek's been gone for a year though. They still won.
That's true. That's true. But you know, it's a real big hole right now. So
I mean, yeah. I mean, Kelce is what makes the world go. Clearly.
Absolutely. I mean,
and he was out, and
Chris
out
Jones
of my
was
fantasy
out.
League.
So, you know,
Chris Jones was out.
But hey, I'm happy for my, you know, Detroit Lions fans, because it's been many, many years of shittiness, of being a crappy, sucky team that, you know, I don't even think of the Lions for the longest time, you know, back to like the Barry Sanders years. So
it's an easy team to root for. I think we're all rooting for them. Definitely don't mind them. You know, future.
Well, besides
NFC.
Our team. Besides our team.
Yeah, of but, course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. But yeah, no, it feels good to be back watching the NFL. You know, by the time this comes out, we will have our first NFL
full
Sunday.
Slate of Sunday games.
Full slate. And I can't wait.
Steelers will be 1-0. The Giants will be 0-1. You know, it's going to be.
Son of a bitch. They got to beat Dallas. For the love of fucking God, please beat Dallas. There's no team I hate to lose to more.
Well, anyways, hey, look, this episode, we had our good friend who was also in our residency. He was actually our senior. He was above us, but you know, it's Dr. Michael Adute, and we talk a lot about prostate cancer. And Justin, what month is it? What kind of awareness month is it?
Well, the month is September. That's the easy part.
That's true.
Most people listening, if you're listening to it when it releases in September, but prostate cancer awareness month is in September. So, you know, we have done interviews, with people who have had prostate cancer. We're going to highlight that again this month. Through our socials, and definitely if you are struggling with prostate cancer, if you're someone who, you know who has prostate cancer, you're a family member, a friend, I think a lot of the resources that we're going to provide you for information this month are going to be very valuable. And so it was about time we really started talking about prostate cancer, and Dr. Adute is really as good as it gets to talk about it. You know, he's a urologic oncologist. He currently practices at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in LA, close to Kevin. So he gets to hang out with Kevin once in a while there. And, you know, he specializes in treatments of the prostate, kidney, and bladder cancers. And, you know, he's actively involved in clinical research. And, you know, several of his unique surgical skills include MRI-targeted prostate biopsy, which we'll go into in depth. And, you know, we break this down into three parts. This is part one now, where we're going to be talking really about the 101 of prostate cancer, just general concepts, what a prostate is, what it does, you know, what PSA is, and general risk factors for prostate cancer and screening. But, you know, Dr. Dut really has done some really amazing New England Journal of Medicine papers on prostate cancer and prostate cancer screening and MRI. So, you know, we do have one of the thought leaders in the field on this episode, and we're really excited to talk to him about it. I'm pumped, and he's a friend of ours for many years at this point that we trained with. So it's very cool to always catch up and hear from him.
Absolutely. And, you know, prostate cancer is tough. You know, it's a tough area in urology. It's definitely undergoing a lot of change right now. And I think what's great about this episode, and we're breaking it over three parts, is that there's so much nuance to it, you know? And the big thing that we're kind of coming across now is like a lot of prostate cancer that you're going to, you know, you may be diagnosed with, you know, it may not be an issue. And I think that's what we're going to really kind of dig into. But there's also the prostate cancer that you absolutely need to get done. And so the field's really changing, and, you know, Dr. Dut's kind of really at the forefront of it, using this MRI imaging to kind of really try to identify the patients that are going to really benefit from it. And so it was a really enjoyable conversation, brought back some old memories from back in residency, and it's great. And, you know, prostate cancer is going to affect a lot of patients, right? I always say to a lot of my patients that I'm diagnosing with it, you know, a lot of guys are going to die with prostate cancer, but the numbers that will die because of are much more fewer. So that's something that, you know, we really kind of have to identify as urologists, and, you know, that's our goal of treatment. So.
Yeah. Listen, it is one of those things where chances are you're going to know someone who has prostate cancer. About 1 in 8 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer during their lifetime. And you know, so it's one of those things that, we all will come to terms with or know someone or have these problems. But the major thing here now, like you said, is information and understanding the disease, because I have to say it's probably one of the most studied diseases and cancers out there. I think we know an insane amount of on prostate cancer, and we're continuing to optimize it. And what many people thought maybe 30 years ago was a death sentence, we're really learning is not, and far from it.
Exactly.
And so, you know, there's a lot to take in on prostate cancer, and we weren't going to be able to put it in one episode. Right. So, you know, in honor of Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, we're going to break it down into three episodes, and so we'll actually extend into October a little bit. But I think a lot of this stuff is very important. It's very relevant for a lot of people who are going through this and family members. But, you know, and one thing that I think we discussed maybe a little bit is testosterone and prostate cancer. That's something that Kevin and I intend on talking about a little bit more on our own in another separate episode, if that's something that people are really interested in. But, you know, I think in general, three episodes is pretty good, but this is a topic that we're going to continue to cover because, you know, there's so much information on it. But I'm really excited. I think that's really it. I got nothing else. You know, I'm ready to go to sleep, to be honest. It's getting late.
I think we should get into the episode. I hope you guys enjoy it, and it's a good listen.
Yep. As always, questions, comments, concerns, feel free to reach out to us on our socials, our emails. You can follow us on @TheManUpPod on TikTok, Instagram. Subscribe, download on YouTube. Also, we're found on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon Prime. Give us a review. That's always, always appreciated. And Kevin, what's our website where they can find us there?
Our website is www.themanuppod.com.
All right, let's get into the episode. Enjoy, guys. Go Giants.
Go Steelers.
1-0. Both 1-0. Both 1-0 by the time this comes out.
Both 1-0.
All right.
Watch them be both 0-1. All right, anyways, here's the episode.
As men's health specialists, we know guys are shaving their balls. Yeah, we examine a lot of you, so we literally see it, but we also have the data showing it, too.
That's right. According to research, over 85% of men trim their pubes. Not only that, but research shows that over 70% of women prefer a partner with at least partially trimmed pubic hair.
So guys, we know you're trimming the edges, and we know that most women prefer you manscape. So if you're going to shave your balls, why not use the best men's grooming kit around? We're talking about Manscaped.
With the Manscaped Performance Package 4.0, you get the Lawnmower 4.0 with their all-new skin-safe electric trimmer that protects your balls from getting those cuts we've all had in the past. You also get the Weed Whacker 2.0 for trimming your nose and ear hairs. And let me tell you guys, we all need to do a better job of this.
Yep, that's right. Kevin and I both have the Performance Package, and we really love it. Manscaping has never been easier for us. And for our listeners, we have a special promotion. Go to manscaped.com and enter promo code MANUP and get 20% off your first purchase.
Go get your Manscaped products today. Your balls and your partner will thank you. All right, so we are very fortunate to be joined today by Dr. Michael Adut. Dr. Dute's well known to Justin and I. We all went to residency together, and you know, Dr. Dute was actually our chief. He was one of our superiors. Just for our listeners who don't really understand urology residency, but basically, you know, you have people coming in at every year, and you know, the people with the most responsibility are the ones at the top. So Dr. Dute really taught us a lot, and kind of laid the foundation for Justin and I's understanding and operating skills. So Dr. Adut, thank you for coming on and taking the time to talk prostate cancer.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
All right. Very good. So let's jump in.
All right, Mikey. So
let's talk prostate cancer. All right. So first off, you know, what is the prostate and what does it do?
All right, so prostate's a gland, so it means it makes excretory fluids, and it's part of the male reproductive system. And so when a man ejaculates, about 1/6 of the fluid that comes out in the ejaculate is fluid that's produced by the prostate. And most of it is just fluids that support semen or support sperm when you have sex to make the sperm function better, be in a little more liquid environment, provide some sugar for the sperm to survive on. It's just a lot of support things. There's some proteins that are produced by the prostate, like PSA, which is very important. We'll actually talk about that a lot. There's a little bit of acid produced by the prostate, citric acid, which reduces the pH. But simply put, it's a organ that excretes fluids that support sperm, largely.
All right, cool. Now, obviously, one of the big things that guys worry about, one of the big topics is prostate cancer, which is why we're having you on here. In a big picture way, really, how common is prostate cancer, and how many men are really diagnosed with prostate cancer every year?
So prostate cancer is actually very common. It's the most common cancer in men, like bar none. It's the most common cancer. Any individual, so any individual has about a 15% lifetime risk of prostate cancer. That's actually pretty high.
15%.
The good news is that prostate cancer is Yeah, it's a lot, right? So it's important that you kind of understand this, because not everyone dies of prostate cancer, and there's kind of a gradient of prostate cancer. Some that are very bad, you really should take seriously, some that really aren't. And so the lifetime risk of dying of prostate cancer is about 3%, meaning of all deaths, about 3% are attributable to prostate cancer. So it's not huge when you consider that 15% of people have it. Total numbers in the U.S., it's around 290,000 people a year are diagnosed with prostate cancer. That's a lot. And around 35,000 people a year die of prostate cancer. So it's prevalent. And for many people, it can be deadly. And for many, it's not. And really knowing the difference is super, super, super important.
So Mike, what are the most important risk factors for getting prostate cancer?
All right. So probably the biggest thing is actually if you have like a known germline alteration. So there are people who have genetic alterations or changes that increase your risk of cancers. Like very common ones are the ones you hear about for breast cancer all the time, like BRCA, BRCA1, BRCA2. These are genes that are normally people think of being associated with causing breast cancer, but actually in men, it causes prostate cancer. There's a whole list of germline alterations or gene alterations that increase your cancer risk, but these aren't super common. So like the average person doesn't usually have these, or unless they have like a very strong family history of cancer. So, you know, if you don't have one of these, but you have a family member who has prostate cancer, like a first degree relative, like brother, sister, mom, dad, your risk of having prostate cancer is about 3.5 times higher than the average population. But there's other things. Yeah. Yeah. It's,
I mean, listen. Yeah. So there is so many genetics things. I think that the BRCA is really important because a lot of people just, especially guys, they associate, and the media kind of really mostly harps on that when it terms in terms of breast cancer. But obviously having a family history in that is very important. And knowing your family history in general sounds like it is a huge, huge factor, guys. So, you know, you really need to be motivated by that. I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead. Keep going. But I just wanted to really highlight that.
I think you make a good point. And so, like, if, for example, your mother had breast cancer and you're a man.
Right.
And she gets a genetic change. Like, she gets a genetic test or doesn't get a genetic test, let's just say. With your mother's breast cancer risk, you actually might be at risk of prostate cancer because these genes that are altered are largely, that can cause multiple cancers essentially. And so it's important to know that just because you're like, you have a female sibling who had breast cancer, you may actually be at risk for prostate cancer. And the best way to kind of do this process is the person who has the actual cancer, they get genetic testing. And if they have a genetic alteration, then there's a 50% chance that one of your relatives would have it. So, you know, if your mom had it, 50% chance she passed it to you, because these are all dominant genes.
Interesting. And then some other risk factors, I think smoking is definitely one, right?
Smoking's a big one. People who are obese tend to have more prostate cancer, and meat consumption, especially like cooked meats. We find that populations that have a lot of cooked meat tend to have higher rates of prostate cancer.
So is it red meat? This is important. Let's talk about that for a second. Cause you know, obviously, smoking, obviously another reason people just think about lung cancer. We've highlighted on this podcast many times that it's not just lung cancer, prostate cancer, obesity. There's so many problems with obesity. We know that now cancer, your prostate included, but let's talk about meat. That's been a big thing, I think, recently. Kevin, we were talking about this before. Kevin's in LA. I'm in Miami. So people are trying to eat healthy and be skinny. Is it what is the risk of red meat and prostate cancer? Or is it red meat? Is it regular meat? All meat? Tell us.
So this is a really hard one to pin down because you got to look at it from the perspective of a scientist, right? So the scientist is going to say, okay, how can I answer this question the best way I can? And they'll say like, okay, can I take group one and group two and randomize people and say, hey, from today, for the next 40 years, you're vegan. And for the next 40 years, you're only eating fish. And for the next 40 years, person C, you're only eating meat. And then this person's only eating poultry. You can't do it. Nobody would actually abide
correct
by that design.
It's impossible.
So what they end up doing is they do sort of cross-sectional studies. They say, okay, let's take a sampling of 5,000 people, ask right them what their dietary patterns are, and see what their rates of cancer are, essentially. Or they say, oh, let's look at all these people who had prostate cancer, see what percentage of them are having meat consumption versus non-meat consumption, so on and so forth. So this study design is inherently flawed. It's not very good at saying like this person has this much higher risk than that, but it's inherently flawed. Taking that into account, we find that the vegans actually have the lowest rates of prostate cancer, lowest rates of colon cancer. There's quite a few cancers that are lower in vegans. And we are not sure what the cause is, but we do have two things that do appear to be positively correlated with increased risk of prostate cancer. And that is dairy consumption and cooked meat consumption. And I cannot specify what kind of meat because these studies didn't necessarily do it. But I would speculate that probably one of the most harmful things is actually going to be the way the meat's cooked. So if you, when you smoke meat, you create nitrates, which are carcinogens. When you burn meat, you also create carcinogens. So all that gristle on the edge of the meat that tastes great, it's actually not very good for you and it increases your risk of cancers. And so as multiple cancers. Yeah. So like gastric cancer rates are much higher. For example, a cook who works at the line cook on the barbecue, those guys have much higher cancer rates than those who are the, you know, platers in the same kitchen.
All right. So let's talk about ejaculation. There's a recent paper came out discussing the role of frequent ejaculation and the risk of prostate cancer. So Mike, Dr. Dude, does it matter?
So there's actually a few papers on this topic now, and there's even meta-analysis on the topic where they kind of take multiple studies and they try to combine all the data from all the studies and see if there's like an agreement or like a consensus among all the studies. And the consensus kind of is that there is a reduction in the risk of prostate cancer when you have frequent ejaculation. Most of these studies required ejaculation to be like 21 times out of
that's
a 30-day
it?
Period.
21, huh?
Yeah, we used to call him Kevin the Stallion. Kevin's like, guys, I'll be right back. I got to take a break for my prostate health.
But what does the data say? What does the data say?
So the synthesis of the data, which is kind of what you want to go for if you can, when there's enough studies to have a meta-analysis, says there's about a 9% reduction in prostate cancer. So if you're like, you know, draining the pipes on a near daily basis, your risk of prostate cancer is about 9% lower than the people who almost never drain their pipes.
All right. Well,
so let's talk about that. Wait, let's talk about it. Okay. Just purely from a numbers perspective, if you're telling me that I could do something to decrease my chances of having some sort of cancer by 10, almost 10%, I mean, shouldn't everyone be doing it?
This is how I look at it. Like you see online, you see all these people who are like doing these like no nut Novembers where like they try to not ejaculate for a
let's
month.
Let's not get into these people. Like, yeah.
People who like try to refrain from ejaculation or masturbation because they feel like some stigma or like some social pressure or they feel like they're bad people for it. I mean, I think you can just throw that out the door because there is evidence that this is like a normal biologic process. If you don't ejaculate for a long time, people start having wet dreams and they get these ejaculatory fluids out. And there's evidence that it's actually like protective for cancer. So, you know, it's all about interpreting the data in like a sensible way. So if you can look at this and be like, okay, like there's some biological benefit to ejaculation. So I probably shouldn't feel so stigmatized for having an ejaculation, for masturbating, any of that stuff. And the converse is like, you shouldn't be using this data. It's like pressure your girlfriend to make you have an orgasm.
Right,
like,
right.
That's absurd too. So like, it's not like, you know, there's some, it's just you have to be use some common sense when you interpret literature, and you need to look at literature and like at times be like, that doesn't make sense. That sounds like BS, and try to figure out why these things aren't lining up. And that's where hopefully the scientists and the researchers in this field are giving you sensible advice. And that's why we usually look at like 3, 4, 5 studies are like, are these all congruent or is like this an outlier? And if there's an outlier study and everyone else is saying this thing, then probably everyone else is right because the cumulative data is saying one thing and there's an outlier study.
I think the bottom line, your summary is really good. I mean, you know, there's always confounding factors that are hard to look at as well. I didn't look at that meta-analysis, but in general, you know, people who are having sex more frequently are probably healthier in general. They have better, like, you know, better heart quality. They're probably more exercised. They're probably not the obese guy. It's not always true. A lot of fat people have sex, and I'm not saying that, but when your terms of your penis health is a big, you know, as we've talked about, is a big, surrogate for your overall health, right, in many ways. But I do think what you said is the more important thing. You know, it's okay to ejaculate. There's data showing that it can help you and improve your health, but you shouldn't have pressure or you shouldn't feel stressed out about having to ejaculate 20 times a fucking month in order to reduce your prostate cancer, because that's also a crazy thing to do. Like, enjoy yourself, but don't feel like you shouldn't be enjoying yourself either. That's my take.
Now, if ejaculating 21 times a month resulted in your prostate cancer risk being reduced by 90%, I would actually encourage you to do it. But this is a pretty small amount. It's like a 9% difference. So, you know, and we were just talking about diet, and most of these diet changes lead to around a 10% reduction-ish in prostate cancer. And like, basically, if you take this stuff in summary, it's like the vegans have lower rates of prostate cancer than meat eaters. It appears that like pescatarians are pretty comparable to the vegans. They're likely the source of the increased risk is probably from the animal-based fats, because there are studies looking at just animal-based fats and seeing if, or animal sources of fat, and those people tend to have the higher risk. But again, these are all showing like a 10% difference. It's not huge. The reason why there's so much enthusiasm for vegan diets is because it's not only reduction in prostate cancer. These people also have lower right. colon cancer risk, gastric cancer risk. They have lower all-cause mortality because the risk of heart attack and stroke is substantially lower, about 25% lower than the average population. And so I think that's like the biggest thing. When you look at the number one killer, it's cardiovascular disease, so heart attack and stroke. And if you can reduce that risk by 25%, that's huge. And then the second leading cause of death is cancer. And if you can reduce that risk by, let's say, maybe 5 to 10, maybe 15% in the optimal cases by being a plant-based vegan.
And jerking every day.
You got to get that combo in, right? It's got to be that combo.
You actually do have a substantial improvement in the likelihood of living longer. And that's why they see, like, you know, observational studies look at like Seventh-day Adventists who have a high percentage of vegetarianism in their lifestyle tend to live longer than the average, you know, omnivore or like meat and vegetable consumer. And so there's a lot of these sort of studies where you look at huge populations and the populations that are truly more towards a plant-based diet and a whole food plant-based diet tend to do better in terms of living longer with less medical problems and being lighter, meaning not as a lower rates of obesity than those who don't. And I used to look at all this and I was like, come on, this is silly. This is stupid. And when I started fellowship, I had enough time to like kind of sit down and read the primary literature and actually pulled up all these papers. It's like, oh, I actually have weekends for once. This is amazing. And I'm not working. And
so you read papers on your weekend. Okay, continue.
Yeah. I'm a total nerd. We all know that. So I was just kind of like shocked. I'm like, oh my God, this like fanatical stuff I see on YouTube with these doctors who seem like this guy, like nutritionfacts.org. This guy has like this whole very pro-vegan diet page where he like cites references and literature. And in the beginning, it was like really high quality studies. And I was like, oh, this is good. And then he like made more videos and more videos and more videos. And then like they're like smaller studies that are like more and more BS and less strong data. I'm like, okay, you're kind of reaching now to make these conclusions. But when I read the big studies, I was like, oh, wow, there's adequate evidence for me to be convinced. And so I'm trying to move my lifestyle more and more towards a vegan diet and sort of reducing the amount of animal protein with the exception of fish, because it seems that the vegans who are pescatarian have pretty comparable risk to those that are just truly vegan in terms of cardiovascular disease risk and the cancer risks. So that's kind of how I'm trying to live it, because I see that there is some evidence.
I love that, Mike. But I want to highlight one thing that you said when you gave us your explanation of how you kind of, you know, when you were looking up the diet, vegan diet and all the benefits, and you highlighted the one thing about how, as in one of these content creators, you know, as they kept going deeper, they started picking more papers out that were, you know, much more, the data wasn't as conclusive, but importantly, the headline might be more, you know, I don't want to say bait clicky or more, you know, how do I say it? Like, you know, it's a headline, right? Like, wow, this is going to improve this. And it's important that you can't, just because a paper is published, you have to kind of dig deep. And that's what you did. You got to dig deep, understand it, see the limitations of it, because every study has limitations. And so, you know, that's something important. Just because you read one sentence that says a paper published it, doesn't mean it's necessarily true or reflective.
And I think that's a great point too, because, you know, especially for our listeners, most of our listeners are not doctors, they're not PhDs, they're not scientists. You reading a study is different from Mike reading a study and from me or Kevin reading a study and understanding what it is. You know, having read a study, you know, there's all this stuff. I'm not going to get political, but like the RFK Jr. stuff. I read a study and this study says this. It's like, dude, you don't even know how to interpret paper. You're a lawyer. You're not a doctor. You're not a scientist. So it is very important. I don't know if Mikey agrees there, but anyway, I mean, the point being is there's a lot of data out there, and for a lot of people, you can find an argument to support your argument for a study that exists. But I think Mike, you brought up a good point where the big picture stuff, does support the data. Now I do want to pivot, because a lot of the things we were talking about here was, you know, risk of prostate cancer, we didn't highlight the actual chances of dying from prostate cancer. Obviously, no one wants to get prostate cancer, but if you are actually diagnosed with prostate cancer, is it a very treatable disease? What are the chances of actually dying from prostate cancer? Obviously, there's different levels of prostate cancer, which we'll get into, but...
Yeah, so that's like a very big question, and I can jump into that. But I do want to make a comment about what you're saying earlier about, like, you know, lawyers reading primary literature and all that. I actually strongly encourage it because when you look at the data, there's like data that is basically, go on the internet, you type in, what's my risk of dying of prostate cancer? What can I do to prevent prostate cancer? You're going to get a whole bunch of garbage. The vast majority of the content on the internet is produced by non-reputable sources. In other words, people who don't have expertise in doing this stuff, who don't have enough knowledge to educate you appropriately, and they're just regurgitating the same content that's been written in like low-level books usually that were not usually written by experts, and then just regurgitated. So we just get like, it's crazy because if you go and you look at like textbooks from the 50s and 60s and 70s, you look at the textbooks now, so many of them are almost the same.
Correct.
The primary literature evolves, and then people just end up updating the book chapters with like minor changes, but it's essentially the same content. So the true science is, or the true data from the publications is where you're going to find the information. And what people need to do is be directed towards that and then be taught how to find good data. So if you're going to look for studies on your own and you're a sort of a lay person, the best way and simplest way to do this is to go to first find a reputable source. And this is what's happening now with like YouTube now and podcasts, is people have access to experts in the field. Like, I'm an expert in prostate cancer, bladder cancer. There's like two things that I write a lot about. I'm very knowledgeable in those spaces. So you can go and find an expert and get their opinion, or you can try to also bolster your own knowledge by going to PubMed. So you Google PubMed. And then there's an option to select what kind of studies you want to go for. And just go for only meta-analyses. And if you just collect meta-analyses, you're going to get essentially only studies that have like a synthesis of multiple studies. So this is like someone who's some degree of expert in the field, or being supervised by some degree of expert in the field, takes all the data, accumulates it together, and then gives you the summary of the data. And you can look at that and be like, okay, there's something here. And then take that information and go speak to a professional and ask them. Oftentimes, when you're armed with a little bit of data, you can now parse out whether or not the physician you're seeing is an expert in that field or not. Like, I love when people come to me and they're like, I read this, I read that, and this is what I think. And they kind of try and challenge me. They're like, hey, well, what about this? What about that? I'm like, this is good. This guy's trying. He's investing in his health. And I can bounce ideas off of them. Now, you go to your doctor, you bring those things up, and they're not forthright, or they're combative with you, and they're like, no, don't listen to that stuff. That's maybe not the best relationship, because either they're not taking you seriously, or maybe they just don't know that stuff that well. Because like, you come to me, you ask me stuff about infertility. Well, I'm a urologist, I should know all that, but I just don't know it as well as Justin Dubin does, or Kevin Chu. Those guys, they both know infertility very, very well. They have fellowship training in it, and I can look at a semen analysis and tell you if it's normal or not. And if it's not, so I'll be like, hey, you need to go see my specialist, because I don't know how to fix many of these problems. I know some of them, but I'm definitely not an expert. I shouldn't be interpreting stuff. And when people come to me with those questions, I'll tell them, hey, this is not my expertise. I know this to some level, definitely more than the average person, definitely more than someone who goes and Google stuff on their own. But I will not know this as well as an expert. You should go to an expert. But if you have cancer, you should come to me, because that's where my expertise is. And I'll have unique knowledge that exceeds, you know, most urologists. Anyway, sorry, okay. I just a rant, but I really
good.
Care about
no,
that.
Hey, listen, I'm glad you brought it up. I think it's important. And I actually think we should have you on for a different episode just about finding good information online. Because we did an episode about bad information. We'll have you on for a good episode of getting good information. And I think that's a great topic that you're clearly passionate about, and you're very good at teaching it. So I think that would be a really good side additional episode we'll have you on. But let's get back to the cancer for now.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So cancer. So if you have prostate cancer, what's the risk of dying from it? And so, you know, that's a tough question. And specifically, I think it's a really important one to answer. If you look at like what happens if you do nothing, and we actually have two clinical trials, two randomized trials, where they diagnose people with prostate cancer and they said, okay, you guys, we're going to just watch you and we're going to do nothing unless your prostate cancer metastasizes. And you guys, we're going to just like take your prostate out because you have cancer. We're going to just see what happens. And so this is done in like the late 90s, early 2000s, right after PSA testing became popular in the late 80s. And at that point, they kind of weren't sure if prostate cancer treatment actually made people live longer. They're like, there are people who are like, hey, you know,
right.
People don't die that much from prostate cancer. It seems maybe you guys aren't helping anyone with these prostatectomies that now everybody seems to be getting because of PSA testing. You got to understand when PSA testing came about, they were detecting twice as many prostate cancers as before. It's a big deal.
It's a big number.
So people are like, yeah, is this better or not? So there's two studies, the Scandinavian Prostate Cancer Research Group, SPG.
It's a lot of letters and numbers.
PCG4 and Pivot. And these are the two trials that were published. I'm actually going to be making a video on this on my YouTube channel called Cancer Better.
Love it.
This specific topic. So this will be hammered, like shown with all the data for people to understand later on. But basically, they classified these people into like the low risk group. And these are people with a PSA under 10 and grade group 1 prostate cancer. People with intermediate risk group, which is Gleason 7s or grade group 2. This is like on the spectrum of worst, least bad cancer to the worst. This is like lower middle. And then people with high risk prostate cancer. So anything that was a Gleason 8 or grade group 4 or higher, or a PSA that was really high, like above 20. And so this is where it gets really interesting. So let's look at the intermediate risk group people. These are the people that were like the Gleason 7s, because we don't really treat Gleason grade group 6 or grade group 1 anymore. The lowest risk prostate cancer group, which is about a third of all prostate cancers, we don't even treat them anymore. We just watch them. But for the intermediate risk people, and back in those days, this is like older technology before we had MRI, before we were diagnosing things as well as we are now. Back then, they would diagnose people with this cancer, and then they'd watch them at 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 23 years out in one study. And at 5 years, the people who had surgery and the people in this intermediate risk group, these Gleason 7s, people who had surgery and people who just had nothing, like they just left them alone, at 5 years, the risk of dying of prostate cancer in the two arms was almost identical, around 3 or 4%. That's kind of crazy.
That's crazy.
So the people who are doing this study at 5 years are like, oh my God, surgery is terrible. It doesn't do anything. Why are we doing that? Why are we operating on these people? But then you wait out to, then you fall, check them again at 10 years, and now the risk of dying of prostate cancer from those who didn't have any treatment at all jumps to 15%, and those who had surgeries somewhere around like 8%. Then at 18 years, the risk of dying for prostate cancer is around 40% if Wow. you had no treatment. Yeah, and those who had the prostatectomy is around somewhere in like the 12, 13% range. So it's a huge risk reduction, but it took 18 years to. And these numbers are kind of similar in both studies, but it took a long time for you to see a difference in survival of prostate cancer. It took 15 years. So all these studies keep coming out showing like, oh, there's this new treatment that is minimally invasive has the same 5-year survival rate as doing prostatectomy. You're like, okay, so what? Doing nothing has the same 5-year outcome as doing a prostatectomy in this intermediate risk group. Now, they didn't have enough patients in the high-risk groups. Like, they didn't have enough people with this Gleason 8 prostate cancer, grade group 4 prostate cancer, these really bad prostate cancers to like, give numbers. But they said those people had a 20 times, that's like 2,000% higher, 20 times higher chance of dying of prostate cancer than the people in intermediate-risk groups. In other words, if you have one of the prostate cancer groups that were in the high-risk category, what they categorized as high-risk back in those times, you had a much, much higher risk of dying of prostate cancer. And so when we synthesize all this data, essentially the takeaway that has sort of worked its way into our guidelines is if you have intermediate-risk prostate cancer and you're likely to die of something else in the next 10 years, it's kind of reasonable maybe not to treat the prostate cancer because the risk of you dying from your other medical conditions is higher. So like if you're 75, they probably won't treat your prostate cancer if you're in the intermediate risk group and your average life expectancy, let's say, is 85. But if you are in the high risk group and like you have this Gleason 8, 9, 10 prostate cancer, or your prostate cancer, for example, on your MRI shows it's growing out of the prostate boundary, it's a high risk feature, then in those groups, we usually say if you're going to live longer than 5 years, it's probably worth treating. But less than 5 years, if your life expectancy is less than 5 years, maybe it's not worth treating. So like if you're someone who just had a stroke and you have bad diabetes and it's poorly controlled, you know, and you're 75, unfortunately, when you put that person's risk assessment in a life expectancy calculator, they're not likely to live past 5 years. And then you're risking causing harm by treating the prostate cancer.
Yeah. Easier said, though, than done in practice. Of course, there are a lot of things in individualized people who do want treatment. And I think the bottom line is you do have to talk with your urologist, your urological oncologist, too.
Yeah, I mean, what I always tell my patients when I'm counseling about even just entering into screening and then like kind of workup, prostate cancer, that's why this episode is great. It's so nuanced, right?
Yes.
It's not just like this. It's not. It's so nuanced. And that frustrates me as a urologist, not going to lie. It can be a frustrating disease because, you know, a lot of times patients will come in, I know we've all experienced this, and they're like, just give me an answer. Just tell me what's next, you know? And it's not that simple with prostate cancer. Yeah. And that's why speaking with experts like Dr. Dude, you're going to really get the really detailed nuances of like, you know, this is why we're doing this, right? And it's kind of personalized in many ways to you, you know?
Completely. Like I even feel bad sharing data sometimes.
Right.
Because like I have this channel where I show like the data because I'm like, you know, it's the stupidest thing. I write these papers and I publish them. And then there's a paywall to go and read the paper.
It's
the
crazy.
Only people who can go and see my paper, is, except for like some of like the New England Journal paper, that's open access. Or like publications I did.
There. Well, just humble brag.
Yeah, that was but like the papers I wrote when I was in fellowship because I was at the NIH, the government institutions have a policy that all their, since they're publicly funded, they must be publicly available. So those papers all are not behind a paywall. We would actually pay the publisher like $5,000 per paper that we wrote for them to publish it and then make money off of us just so that people could see them. But like now I'm no longer at a government institution. The papers I publish now are often ending up behind a paywall.
I mean, that's a whole other thing. We'll reel it back in.
Yeah. Long story short, just having access to the data is huge.
Wait, all right. So, Mike, a common question that patients always ask me, and you know, I'd like you to answer for there is like, you know, what are the signs or symptoms that I may have prostate cancer? That's a common question I always get.
Yeah. So I love this question, and I want to answer this question as many times as I can. Almost no cancers have symptoms until they are quite advanced.
Right.
Bar none, solid statement, for almost every cancer, you will have no symptoms until it is advanced. Okay? I mean, like, there are some exceptions. You look at cancer in general principles. General principles, cancers tend to be bleed easily. So if you find blood is coming out of somewhere that it shouldn't be, like you coughing up blood, might be a sign of lung cancer. You have blood in the urine, might be something happening in the urinary tract. But outside of that, most cancers cause no symptoms at all whatsoever until they are advanced. And I have people come to me all the time, but doc, I feel fine. What do you mean I have cancer? Yeah, we're finding it before it's advanced and we can actually cure you. So this is why screening matters. And
I think it's also important. I think it's so important, and that's why screening matters. And I think the opposite end I hear a lot too is patients say, "Doc, I have urinary problems. Does that mean I have prostate cancer? I can't pee well. Does that mean I have prostate cancer?" And the answer is no, because it's so weird. In terms of your prostate is, I think, the only organ that really grows as you get older, and it's not cancerous many times. Mikey, correct me if I'm wrong. You know better than I, but you know, it is one of those rare things that, you know, having urinary symptoms, having overgrowth of your prostate, BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, is not cancer. But I don't know if you wanted to comment on that as well.
No, I mean, there's no correlation between your prostate size and your likelihood of prostate cancer. You know, this goes back to what Kevin was saying. Like, there's so much nuance in the prostate literature. It's like, okay, well, back in the day, the people with the smaller prostates had more prostate cancer. Why is that? And it's because we used to do prostate biopsies in a way where we couldn't target anything that was abnormal. We just divide the gland into like quadrants, and we just sample in the middle of each quadrant and hope to get it. You can imagine if your prostate's four times bigger than the guy, the next guy, those quadrants are going to be huge and they're likely to be missing something. And those quadrants is way higher. In the last like 5 years, there's been an evolution, and now we use MRIs to try to localize prostate cancer. There's some other strategies like very high sensitivity ultrasounds, which are almost as good as MRI. But basically to say that nowadays we actually can find the abnormal area in the prostate and target biopsies to it.
So, and we're going to get into that, but let's start off. We've been talking about this idea of screening. We've been talking about, you know, a PSA. Now, I think let's start off with like, at what age should men get it, consider getting screened for prostate cancer? Because I think that this has varied a lot over the last years. And I'm sure your opinion versus the primary care doctors that people talk to versus, you know, other people have is different. So in your estimate and your thoughts, at what age should men start getting screened for prostate cancer?
The newest guidelines just reduce the age to 45. And if you have a family history of prostate cancer, or you're African-American, because we find that black men in the United States end up higher risk of prostate cancer and earlier onset, down to 40. So if you have like a first degree relative who had prostate cancer, or if you have one of these, risk factors because of genetic alterations, you should start at 40. And even the germline alteration people, maybe even sooner. And then if you are a normal person who has no family history of prostate cancer, you're not black, at 45. The important thing is, if you're getting your PSA tested, if the PSA starts to look abnormal, you kind of want to get that interpreted by someone who knows what they're doing in the field. So someone who's pretty knowledgeable in prostate cancer. This is in stark contrast to like in 2008, when the U.S. Preventative Task Force said, hey, you should stop doing PSA testing, was crazy because it's nuts to me. Literally yesterday I saw a guy in my clinic whose PSA was 8 and he was told, oh, just ignore it. He was 60, low 60s. And then he got a PSA the next year is 9. And he was told by his primary care, oh, just ignore it. It doesn't make any difference. And I'm thinking, this is insanity. Like, you have a cancer that's completely preventable. We have data, which we just discussed a few minutes ago, showing that intervention leads to much lower mortality rates. And you're young. Like, why not? Like, yeah, I get it. If you're 80, you shouldn't be doing PSA testing because honestly, even if we find your prostate cancer at that age, the likelihood of us intervening and making a difference is very low. It's very low. Like in my entire career, I've done one prostatectomy on a man who was 80 years old because he was in excellent health and he had horrible prostate cancer, but it was still confined. And I was like, I can cure this guy. And that was the only one I did. And I had presented it at the tumor board, got the approval of everyone and all the other doctors were like, yeah, you can do this. I'm like, all right, I did. But like, you know, basically you stop at like 70, if you're really healthy, 75. So it's like something you do from 45 to 70. Maybe if you're a very healthy person, your life expectancy is, 90 or above 85, then go till 75. And then once you get that PSA, you don't just say, oh, my PSA is elevated. Now I have to get a prostate biopsy. I have to do this. I have to do that. No. There's nuance. You got to interpret the data carefully.
So you're touching a lot on the next question that we have, which is, and we keep using the terminology PSA, PSA, PSA. So for our listeners, so what is screening for prostate cancer and, what role does PSA play in it?
All right. So PSA stands for prostate specific antigen. It's basically just a peptide or a protein that's made by the prostate. It helps liquefy the semen. So your sperm want to get to the egg, and it makes it a little bit less viscous. Yep. The sperm can swim through a little bit better. And the cervical mucosa, like the fluids that are inside the woman's vagina and cervix, are also thick. So this kind of helps it, kind of lubricates the process to a degree, helping the sperm get to the egg. This is what's special about PSA is it's a protein that's only made by the prostate. Yep. Like there's no other organ in your body that makes PSA. And so we basically use the PSA as a marker for potentially having prostate cancer. But this is really important. Normal prostate tissue makes PSA. So you can have a high PSA because your prostate is just really big. But prostate cancer also produces PSA. And most of the time, the overwhelming majority of the time, prostate cancer overproduces PSA, meaning it produces more PSA than normal tissue, like by a substantial degree. So your PSA can also be elevated because of cancer. And then last, you will find that your PSA can, we find that your PSA can also be elevated by infection. So someone's PSA being elevated does not mean you have cancer.
Right.
It just means important. There might be cancer.
That's a good point.
So three things that make your PSA high, inflammation, enlargement of the prostate or just growth of the prostate as you age. And then the third is prostate cancer. So it's a screening test. It's not a diagnostic test. It just says, hey, you might be at risk for prostate cancer. Why don't you go talk to an expert and they can tell you what to do next to see if you actually have prostate cancer or it's something else.
I think that's a great summary. And it's so, so important that having an elevated PSA does not necessarily mean you have prostate cancer. Now, I think I need to bring up the digital rectal exam as the finger in the butt, because that is part of the prostate cancer screening process for a lot of people. And I personally have been advocating against it for that. I wrote an opinion piece.
Google Justin Dubin, DRE.
And Mike and I have gone back and forth, I think, in this to some degree. Now, yeah. I think that there's a lot of data suggesting that it prevents a lot of men from coming in. So this is a twofold question. One, what do you think the role of the digital rectal exam for prostate cancer is in the day, in the year 2023, when we have PSA, we have other tests, which we'll get into, and we have the MRI. And then two, you know, if I don't want to get the DRE, and should I still come in for at least the PSA? Because I think that that's an important part that I usually harp on for my patients. Even if you don't want a finger in the butt, which I'm happy to provide, I still want to get the PSA.
Sure, you're very happy to provide that. But I have some news for you. The most recent guidelines actually do not support the use of a digital rectal exam.
Boom.
Justin Dubin.
I saw it, man. Maybe I helped. Maybe they looked at my opinion piece. Probably not.
But with all things, I like to put numbers on these things. And I actually decided to look this up. And I had trouble finding good evidence that was published and analyzed, but I did find primary literature where I was able to make a reverse calculation and sort of figure it out. So there was a large study called the PLCO trial, prostate, lung, colon, ovarian cancer trial. This was a huge screening trial run by the NIH by a guy named Howard Parnes. Fantastic guy. I worked with him when I was there. So smart. Amazing. Anyway, great researcher. And what they did in this study for the prostate cancer screening arm is they had people get a prostate biopsy if their PSA was above 4 or their doctor did a rectal exam and found something abnormal. So I basically looked at their data and I did a reverse calculation and I was like, okay, what percentage of these people were diagnosed with prostate cancer with a PSA below 4 and only a rectal exam that was abnormal? And that was 3% in that study.
Yeah, I thought it was about 2 to 3%. Yeah, I looked at that. Yeah. I also did that.
So, if the risk is about 3%, that means that having a digital rectal exam, having the doctor put their finger in the butt, will probably have a very small effect on prostate cancer identification. Now, again, this is where understanding the data from like a very careful way makes a big difference. This whole population that was included in the study were people that were screened by their primary care doctor,
right,
already found to have an abnormal digital rectal exam, and then thrown into the cohort with the people with the high PSAs, meaning of all the people at risk for prostate cancer, that was 3%. That means that they had to do a rectal exam on a huge number of people in order to get those 3% of people who found their way into that cohort. You get what I'm saying?
So it's even lower.
So the likelihood of a rectal, the likelihood of a rectal exam leading to a prostate cancer diagnosis in the average population is definitely less than 3%, probably by a lot.
Yeah.
So I do not think a rectal exam is very likely to make a substantial improvement in the likelihood of prostate cancer detection, especially in the era of someone who's getting regular PSA tests. Now, it's important to know that if your PSA is below 4, you still can have prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a recent study published in NEJM where they looked at using a PSA cutoff of 3 and doing an MRI afterwards, and then having that be the cutoff for identifying prostate cancer. And so a lot of people have been advocating for that for quite some time, and that hasn't been an official change, but sometimes it's appropriate to investigate with a PSA even as low as 3, especially in the younger guys. So if like you're, you know, below 60 and your PSA is 3, and your prostate isn't very large, it's like a normal size prostate, you really might actually be able to find that prostate cancer very early with a PSA of 3. So there are nuances, again, kind of going back to Kevin's point. It's tough because this is such a nuanced space.
But in general,
so no, a rectal exam is not necessary. Exam is not that great.
So guys, I
only do them.
Justin's like trying to get out.
I'm just trying to say is like, I think it's an important message. Like guys, you don't have to get don't let that be the thing to prevent you from going to your doctor to get screened for prostate cancer. Because there's a lot of data out there saying, you know, guys are happy to go to the doctor if you tell them that they just need to get a blood test, but they won't go to the doctor if they tell them they want a rectal exam. There's a lot of data out there suggesting this. So you can go to your doctor and you can say, hey, listen, I'm happy with just getting the blood test. I want to get screened for prostate cancer. And I think that's our goal today, is to motivate people to go see their doctors. And if that's the barrier, I just really wanted to harp on that. And Mike, Justin, it sounds like data is supporting it.
Justin, you're absolutely correct.
Stamp of approval.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, I had a patient who hadn't followed up with a urologist for 2 years because he was just like, yeah, I had that rectal exam when I got it 2 years ago. It was a bad experience. And they waited 2-3 years before they wanted to come back and continue their surveillance or, you know, screening for prostate cancer. Mike, you kind of touched base a little bit on about like, you know, low PSA, high PSA. So let's kind of tie that back in with diet, right? So there have been publications that have shown that a vegan diet can lower your PSA. Now, so one of the things I kind of grapple with is like, so we use PSA and we kind of use like, you know, we can talk about later, like age adjusted PSAs or like kind of thresholds to kind of determine when that next step is. But if you're on a vegan diet and you're lowering your PSA, are we then missing some potential,
Some potential
patients that would probably get, you know, further diagnostics? I don't know. I get confused.
Yeah. That's a great question. Really, really thoughtful. Cause you're like, well, is this going to reduce our detection? Cause their PS, if you lower your PSA with a vegan diet, are you going to have lower detection? And we don't know for sure, but we do know that the prostate cancer specific mortality in vegans is lower, meaning the risk of dying from prostate cancer is lower. So probably if we're extrapolated out, even though it lowers your PSA, it might lower your detection, but it probably lowers the actual risk of a very bad prostate cancer. So in net, if less people are dying who are vegans of prostate cancer, marginally, it's about the same or a little bit lower. Now, look, Justin kind of mentioned this earlier. It's not a huge difference. Like the vegans in terms of prostate cancer specific mortality is not huge. And some studies say it's the same. So it's like, you know, I wouldn't hang my hat on it. But I would hang my hat on cumulatively, all the data shows that on average, vegans live longer. And that I would hang my hat on. Like, okay, yeah, there's some benefits there.
I think you also brought up just now an important point that I totally forgot about, is this number, this idea of the PSA number and treating PSA number, which is not a thing, right? So like people go on finasteride and it cuts their PSA in half. And some patients think, oh, well, my PSA went from 5 to... Yeah. You know, 2.5, I'm great now. I don't have to worry about prostate cancer. Just want to get your comments on that because we know that that's not the case. That is a situation where we're hiding a PSA, a true PSA. And, you know, we're not treating a number. We're using a number for a diagnostic, approach or a screening approach.
Yeah. So if you're on finasteride or dutasteride, any of these medications that shrink your prostate, they will lower your PSA to half of its original value. If your PSA does not lower to half of its original value and stays above half, that's actually a risk factor for having prostate cancer because these medications will shrink only normal prostate tissue. They will have no effect on prostate cancer.
Great point.
So if you're on these medications, you have to take your PSA and multiply it by 2. So if you're on finasteride and your PSA is 2.5, you need to multiply it by 2, and then it'll tell you whether you're in the normal range or not. These computer systems that report your value will say normal, but it doesn't do the back calculation to double it for you. So again, another piece of nuance that Kevin was talking about, like if you go see a urologist, this is, you know, bread and butter stuff. We would know this, but your primary care doctor, very easy, they wouldn't know that.
So Mike, you just touched on two things that I kind of want to just get some quick thoughts on actually, since we're here talking about it. So, you know, some of my patients have Googled, they'll Google finasteride and prostate cancer. And I think a couple years ago, something came out basically saying that if you take finasteride, you have an increased chance for high risk prostate cancer, or maybe, you know, correct me if that's wrong. they said that. And then also earlier, though, taking dutasteride in one of these big scale trials showed decrease. So can you kind of just elaborate? Because a lot of my patients who Google asked me about that.
It's a great question.
I mean, this happens to me all the time. I prescribe these medications for people. Then they come back like, oh, I'm going to get prostate. They tell me this causes prostate cancer. I'm not going to take it. I love this topic. I'm actually pulling our data at Cedars-Sinai to validate this point.
Very cool.
I want to demonstrate this. This is very cool. So we have a huge database we're trying to generate right now and excited to publish it. But finasteride, dutasteride, these medications that shrink the prostate, they actually were shown to have a reduction in the total number of prostate cancer diagnoses by about a third in both studies. However, there was, while the net prostate cancer diagnosis went down, there was more detection of the dangerous prostate cancer, the high-grade prostate cancer, Gleason 8 or 7 or higher, excuse me, in these cohorts. And then you kind of scratch your head. You're like, I don't get it. How is the same drug reducing the rates of mostly low-risk prostate cancer, the ones we don't treat, and then increasing the rates of the high-grade ones? And this has been largely debunked as a cause for increasing high-risk prostate cancer. But basically what was happening is these studies were all done in the pre-MRI era, where we had no way to localize areas of prostate cancer. And this kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier. So since these medications, finasteride, dutasteride, shrink your prostate to about half of its size, you now make, and then you divide it into a quadrant, to these 12 quadrants and biopsy it. The quadrant biopsy system, what we call a systematic biopsy system, would lead to more cancer detection in the people with smaller glands. So if you shrink the gland, you get more cancer detection. Right? So it's just kind of like a function of the way we did things. And now in the early 2000s, we entered this MRI era where everyone's using an MRI. Well, not everyone, unfortunately. a lot of like advanced doctors are using MRIs to try to identify the area that's abnormal in the prostate, then target the biopsies to that area. And so if you were to repeat the exact same study, give someone finasteride, and then do a targeted biopsy, I bet you'd get the exact same rates. And so after these papers came out, tons of urologists published their papers, their series, editorials, reanalysis of the data, just saying like, this kind of doesn't pan out. And so unfortunately, the labels still say, hey, clinical studies say this leads to prostate cancer. And it's still on the boxes, even though tons of us have demonstrated, tons of urologists and other scientists have demonstrated this is likely not a real phenomenon. And actually just led to better detection of those high-risk prostate cancers. Again, all things in science require data. That's why I'm trying to write more papers on this. And our design is essentially going to be people who get finasteride and got targeted biopsies and those who didn't get targeted biopsies, who got just the systematic biopsies, and showing that when the guys got the better biopsy, the more accurate biopsy, that the rates were identical between the two groups, those who were getting
it's so cool. That's such a cool study, and that's such an important clarification. So thank you for clarifying that. All right. Well, I think this was a really good summary. I mean, this was a really awesome. You gave us great data, great studies, great context. I mean, just as a concluding statement, Mike or Dr. Adut, what is your final, you know, if our listeners have to take one thing away about prostate cancer screening and understanding it, is there one message that you want them to take away today?
Yeah. I mean, I think my main takeaway would be like, do PSA testing, just start doing it annually. If it comes back elevated, that's the time to try to find someone who has expertise in cancer. So like, just go and look for the urologist who specializes in cancer and just go talk with the guy. And that person, if they're specialized in cancer treatment, so a urologic oncologist, they'll have like more than enough literature and information to be able to give you some nuance and be like, hey, you know, don't worry about it, probably nothing. Or, oh, this is something you should look into. We should probably talk about a biopsy and that kind of stuff. That's a take home.
Great summary, man. Thanks a lot for coming on. This was absolutely amazing. We're already going to be recording another episode with you and hopefully a third, but just where can people find you online? Where do you practice? You know, obviously we know Cedars-Sinai is right there, but where can people find you online, YouTube and your website?
Sure. I'm working at Cedars. I have a YouTube channel called Cancer Better. The purpose is entirely just to educate people to get cancer treatment that's better.
So like, it's amazing resource. You know,
it's not all the same. All cancer treatment's not the same. There are better options. So I'm just trying to educate people on what the best options are at the current time. You know, I have a Twitter page, Michael Adut, MD, and that's basically the main places where people can find me.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks for coming on. And thanks, as always, to our listeners. As always, you can follow us on our socials at The Man Up Pod. You can go to listen to us on YouTube and subscribe there. You can also download, subscribe, give us a review and comments on Spotify, Amazon, and Apple iTunes. That's always appreciated. Kevin, what's our website?
Our website is www.themanuppod.com.
All right, for Kevin, Dr. Adu, and I, thanks for listening. Until next time, have a good one.